Britain is hard-pressed to find a more ghastly period in modern history than the time before and during World War II, when Nazi Germany undertook an effort to systematically eliminate the Jewish people of Europe. 6 million victims over many years in countries, it was a tragedy without parallel. But the Holocaust had other victims, too. Gypsies, Jehovah's Witnesses, people with mental and physical disabilities. Many groups didn't fit in the ideal of a master race. And among the groups who suffered most broadly and fell the furthest were Germany's gay community. More than 100,000 men arrested for being gay during that era. And an exhibit now here in Kansas City explores the history of that Nazi persecution, in which thousands would go to concentration camps and many would die. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. We're talking today about the Nazi persecution of homosexuals and an exhibit now here in Kansas City exploring that event. And joining us is one of the leaders of one of the sponsoring groups, Stuart Hines. He's the head of the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America, which is part of the UMKC libraries here. Stuart, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you back. The exhibition is a joint project with the Kansas City Museum and also the Office of Diversity, Access, and Equity at UMKC. Tell us how this came to be here in Kansas City.
We were approached last summer by some higher-ups with the Heartland Men's Chorus. They were planning their 2012-2013 schedule, and their spring concert focuses on this period of time in Germany. And they asked if we would be interested in hosting this touring exhibit from the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. And as it turned out, we have a very nice gallery space at Miller Nichols Library here on the UMKC campus. And it was free in terms of the calendar. The Office of Diversity, Access, and Equity was very interested in bringing it to the campus, and so all the pieces fell into place, and it worked out beautifully, and that's how it was able to come here.
Now I know there's other, you mentioned the Heartland Men's Chorus, their concert is in connection with this. What other programs and partnerships have been part of this exhibit?
In terms of programming, we at the library are hosting a small film series in March. March 6th and March 13th, it's a brown bag lunch film series, really in an effort to draw students and campus population, but the community is welcome as well. We're showing the film adaptation of the 1980 play Bent, which focuses on two imprisoned gay men. And the second film on the 13th is a documentary entitled Paragraph 175 about the law that criminalized homosexual behavior.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, about sort of the history that that gives rise to this exhibit. What was Paragraph 175?
Paragraph 175 was a law that was enacted in 1871 with the founding of the Second Reich, and it outlawed essentially homosexual acts between two men. It didn't include lesbians. There were efforts over time to include women as part of this particular law, but they never made it to the books. When the Nazis came to power, they enlarged the scope of the law to include not only sexual activity between men, but inclinations towards that, even as the title of the Heartland Men's Chorus piece is a look or a touch. So a look or a glance or a touch, or just the perception that one could be.
Which probably then opened up possibility of rumors, of wild speculation.
Absolutely. You could turn someone in who might be predisposed to being a homosexual.
So a phone, a call to the police might be all it would take to get
sure.
someone arrested.
Sure.
What was it like? So this is 1933 when the Nazis came to power. What was it like before that in Germany? You said this law was on the books from the days of the Kaisers, but what was happening in real life?
During the Weimar period, actually, there was a really active and strong gay and lesbian presence that was emerging. It was a really strong movement, and there were efforts to repeal the law from basically the time, from late 19th century, 1890s on. There were advances in the study of sexual behavior. Magnus Hirschfeld was a gay Jewish man who really led that effort in Germany.
In an academic sense.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yeah. And socially, there were in late Weimar, in Berlin, there were over 100 gay and lesbian bars. In 1905, there were over 300 gay periodicals being published in Germany. So there was lots of activity.
So, yeah, it was a thriving culture.
Right. It's not to say that people didn't get arrested. Several hundred, between 600 and 800 people will get arrested every year for violating paragraph 175.
So who was being arrested before the Nazis came to power? Did it take a particularly egregious violation, was there still an atmosphere?
That's the sense that I get, that it was a pretty extreme to draw the attention of the authorities.
So the Nazis come to power partly on a platform of what I don't know we might call traditional values, that culture was in fact a campaign issue. Am I right?
It was, and that's also largely a reason why they didn't expend a lot of energy towards the lesbian community, because of those traditional values and the gender stereotypes and the gender roles that the Nazis really focused on and really enforced.
Say more about that. Why would lesbians present less of a threat or a problem?
Because ultimately, and as unpleasant as it sounds, to the Nazis, they were very focused on producing the master race, the Aryan race. And ultimately, even though they might be lesbians, these women could still be used to produce Aryan babies.
Hmm. And so it was really the men who would not be producing children.
Absolutely. The men were degenerates. They were contributing to the decline of the population, and they couldn't be used to produce the stock.
Was it just the lack of procreation that was the concern, or were there other concerns about the effect of homosexuality on the culture of Germany?
There were concerns about the effect on the culture. They felt that not only did it dilute the race, but it led to the decline of the culture, and the degeneracy would spread throughout the culture if these men were allowed to remain free.
We're talking with Stuart Hines. He's the director of special collections of the UMKC Libraries, and he is with us to talk about the exhibit currently on display, a traveling exhibit about Nazi persecution of homosexuals. It's on display now at the Miller Nichols Library here on the UMKC campus, which you can read more about on our website, which is kcur.org. Stuart, talk to us a little bit about the ideology that more broadly that gives rise to this this set of legislative and political and police activities. Where does this come from, this fear really of homosexuality?
A lot of it comes almost directly from Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of the Gestapo, and he was also in charge of setting up the concentration camps, and he was obsessed with the propagation of the Aryan race. And anything that would stand in the way of that, he wanted to eliminate. And he was particularly disgusted by gay men. Mm. And so he really threw a lot of energy behind the efforts to get men arrested and get them into camps.
And he really, and this sort of picked up as the Nazi regime wore on, and particularly once the war began, right?
Absolutely. In fact, in the first 3 years after the expansion of paragraph 175, there, because of Himmler's efforts, 78,000 men were arrested.
78,000 in the first year?
In the first 3 years.
First 3 years.
Yeah.
I wonder, how did they find out who to arrest? Who were these informants?
Well, typically what would happen is they would arrest one person, and for being either known or at a bar or at a public a space in the public sphere that was known as a cruising space, for example. Hmm. And then they would torture that person until that person gave up names of the people that they knew, and so it was just a snowball effect.
Mm. And were certain gay men more vulnerable, more likely to be arrested than others?
The ones who were out in public or out at bars or visible.
I saw in the exhibit that often would mean blue collar, maybe lower income.
Yes.
Gay men.
Yes. That's the case.
Because they couldn't go anywhere to.
They didn't have anywhere else to go. Right.
Were the victims of this exclusively German gay men, or as the Nazis occupied other countries, was all of Europe at risk?
The thrust really was aimed at the German population. Himmler's thinking being, particularly with regard to Eastern Europe and truly non-Aryan nations, it's okay to leave the gay men out in those populations because that helps to ultimately eliminate those populations, which can only contribute to the growth of the Aryan nation.
Hmm.
So
in a way, it was if there's a Polish or an Austrian gay person, that's of no concern to him.
That's of less concern, much less concern.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We'll invite our listeners. If you've seen the exhibition, what stood out to you? Or maybe you've heard about this issue in the past. Why do you think this really matters for today, the Nazi persecution of homosexuals in the 30s and 40s? Could it happen again? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We've talked about the 78,000 who were arrested in those first 3 years. It was over 100,000 by the time the war was done. What typically happened to someone who was arrested for being gay?
Typically, they went to prison, and for the unlucky ones, they went on to a concentration camp. And as it worked out, the gay men weren't sent directly to the death camps, the camps that most folks have heard about, the Auschwitz, the Dachau, those camps. They went to work camps, the smaller camps that were scattered throughout Germany, Austria, and Poland. And there, they were worked to death.
Literally?
Literally worked to death. They went and were given the jobs that were the hardest to do, things like stone quarries or brick manufacturers. And just the intensity of that work and the conditions of the camp resulted in people just dying.
And that was not an accident.
No, that was intentional. And once they got into the camps, they were the lowest of the low. They were shunned by the other inmates in the camps because they were identified by their pink triangle, and no one wanted to have anything to do with them. And so as a result, there was that sense of isolation as well as just the sheer brutality of the guards and the work that they were forced to do.
All right, this is the origin of the pink triangle, right?
It is the origin.
Which goes on to become a symbol of empowerment.
Mm-hmm. Around the time of the AIDS crisis in the early 80s, that's when you really see the evolution of the pink triangle become a symbol of empowerment. Yeah,
the homosexuals who were forced to wear the pink triangle, that was a sign to cause them to be discriminated against by other prisoners and by guards, or was it to make them feel ashamed? What was the thinking? And of course, that wasn't the only symbol that concentration.
No, the very organized Germans gave the different populations their badges. The politicals were red triangles. The criminals were green triangles, and of course the Jewish population wore the yellow stars, and it was a means of efficiency as well as identification and communication. I mean, you knew immediately that the people you were surrounded with, why they were there.
Mm. There were, of course, some, as you mentioned, who went to the concentration camps. Others were assigned to mental health or mental illness wards and to institutions. It sounded like some of those prisoners or those who were incarcerated there suffered the worst fates.
They suffered horrible fates. They were part of a very broad medical experimentation that was conducted by Nazi doctors throughout the camps. And the one procedure that I see mentioned over and over is castration, and then filling people up with testosterone to see if that would turn them straight.
Hmm.
And typically, it didn't, and it usually would result in their deaths.
We had an email here from Gabby. She writes, "This is an important conversation, an excellent exhibit," who she saw at the last time it was here in the metro area. She says, "We must remember history can and does repeat itself." She also says, yes, this was 1930s Germany, but Britain in the 80s had an anti-gay law, Clause 28, that Britain just voted in gay marriage does not mean any of us in any country can afford to not be vigilant.
Of course, we have anti-gay laws on the books in Missouri and Kansas that prevent people of the same gender from signing a legal contract of marriage. We have boys, teenage boys in Iran, in Saudi Arabia, in other countries in the Middle East being stoned or hung for being gay. We have the situation in Uganda where people are persecuted. It hasn't and doesn't go away. That's one of the reasons we brought this exhibit here.
It's an interesting note was about military service, which I found really, really fascinating, that in Nazi Germany, you could get out of prison, or even if you were sentenced to prison, you first still had to complete your sentence, your draft requirements. And so often gay men, strangely enough, were sent to be in the military and at the front. No ban on gays in the military, quite on the contrary.
True enough. If their superiors on the front knew that they were gay men, they were typically, given the worst duties to perform, and they were at the very front of the front, basically cannon fodder.
Suicide missions.
Yeah.
We're talking with Stuart Hines, who is director of special collections at the UMKC Libraries and coordinates the Gay and Lesbian Archive of Mid-America. They are together co-sponsoring, along with others, the exhibition of Nazi persecution of homosexuals from 1933 to 1945. It's on display now at the Dean's Gallery in the Miller-Nichols Library on the UMKC campus. Stuart, I'm wondering, you know, the Holocaust, I think, in general, is pretty difficult to comprehend by us in our day and age. I guess I'm moved to ask why you think or how you think this could possibly have happened. I mean, Germany was not an unsophisticated country. It was scientifically advanced, academically sound. How did it go this way?
The right people came to power at the right time. You had people who were sending out the message that the population wanted to hear. They were sending it out in a very effective manner, and they had an excellent propaganda machine. And it's all advertising. That's all it takes.
Have you had a chance since the exhibit opened to talk with visitors to it? Do you have a sense of how this is being received here in Kansas City?
I gave a tour for some members of the chorus over the weekend on Saturday. There were about 30. And walked them through a very brief guided tour and then just sort of observed them as they interacted with the exhibit. And it was quite sobering for them. I'm hoping that it also will inform their performance later on in March 23rd and 24th. But it's been interesting just to see the impact and the sobering impact on folks.
Yeah. I think maybe there's a blind spot in a lot of folks' minds about what was happening here, even in the Kansas City area during that same period in the 30s and 40s was – I can't imagine Kansas City was a model of public acceptance of gays and lesbians.
Not a model of public acceptance, but that doesn't mean there weren't pockets of gay-friendly activity happening, particularly in the 30s, immediately before the war. We have uncovered evidence of female impersonation in the jazz clubs in Kansas City. Hmm. Pretty prevalent, actually. Hmm. And
not something you'd call a drag show back then,
but the same principle. Mm. And although they typically sang their own songs,
okay,
as opposed to lip syncing.
All right.
But so there was, like I say, there were pockets, and that's about the period too that you come to find female impersonation associated with the gay community in a meaningful way.
By the way, I'm curious about the terminology. you and I have both been sort of using the terminology of the gay community, but the exhibit rather rigorously uses the term homosexuals.
It does.
Why is that?
And I think because at the time there wasn't a gay community as such. The law was focused specifically on homosexual behavior, and that was performed by homosexuals. And so that's why I think that the exhibit really tends to use that terminology.
Right. Does this feel like ancient history, or does this feel like it is a relevant present topic for today?
To me, it does not feel like ancient history. This occurred during my mother's lifetime. My mother is still living. My mother and Hitler walked the earth at the same time. And it's not that long ago. And that's another one of the reasons why we brought it here. In my lifetime, there were serious calls to quarantine and tattoo and number people who either had HIV disease or were identified as potential carriers. So this kind of ugliness recurs all the time. Mm. And again, that's one of the reasons why we brought the exhibit here, is to keep it in front of people so that they remain vigilant.
Let me ask you one more thing before we go. There's lots of sort of informational displays. There's pictures and photographs. There's some artifacts of the period. What is the one thing in the exhibit that most sort of stands out to you and leaves an impression with you that you think helps us remember why this is important?
The thing that I found most astounding was when the camps were liberated, the men who were in the camps, the Pink Triangle men, the 175ers as they were called, they were in the camps because they had broken the law. The Allied justice system that took over after the war gave these guys credit for time served, but then put them back in jail for the remainder of their terms.
Hmm.
And no one else was treated that way. No other political prisoners, no other people who were in the camps were treated in that fashion.
Wow. Remind us again where folks can go to see all of this.
Mila Nichols Library, the second floor in the Dean's Gallery, as well as a complimentary exhibit at the Kansas City Museum in Corinthian Hall, which opens in early March.
Very good. Stuart Hines is Director of Special Collections for the UMKC Libraries. He is a part of bringing to Kansas City this exhibition of Nazi persecution of homosexuals. Stuart, thanks for taking a few minutes with us this morning.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.